Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast by Bald Move. We're the officially unofficial podcast for HBO's series Game of Thrones. I'm your host, Aaron, and joining me tonight again is...
Anthony.
And Anthony is my co-author of a book we've written, Gods of Thrones. We are the officially official podcast for Gods of Thrones by one Aaron Hubbard and Anthony LaDon. Anthony, thanks for coming on the show again. And we just want to thank everybody who bought our book over the last week. You helped make us the number one release in several categories, especially in religious criticism and literary criticism. We were kind of top of the roost in science fiction and fantasy and history and criticism and religious criticism. So really, really appreciate that. Got a lot of good reviews. And if you purchased a copy or if you got your copy through the Kickstarter campaign, once again, thank you. Thank you very much. So we're pretty excited about this. All through November, we're going to be celebrating the release of Gods of Thrones, our book, as well as George Martin's forthcoming Fire and Blood book that's coming out in November 20th. So we're just kind of flooding the market with new, fresh Game of Thrones content. I thought, Anthony, before we start into the podcast proper, we'd do a little bit of housekeeping.
Sounds good.
Because I know there's like the Kickstarter folks. We've been talking about fulfillment windows sometime in November. And just want to let people know that the first round of fulfillment, if you ordered like just a book only, a physical copy with no other bells and whistles, those things are going to be going out this weekend. And then the week after, we will start fulfilling things like books with the autographs and then books with the t-shirts and books with the hoodies and things like that. So just want to give everybody a little update on that. I had a couple of frequently asked questions, and I picked these from the mailbag, Anthony. One was from Steven S. He says, "Hey guys, is your book available in a paperback version? I would love to check it out, but I don't really enjoy reading on electronic devices versus Kindles, but your book does sound great." We are definitely doing, the Kickstarter people are getting their paperback books shipping real soon now. We are definitely have a print version that's going to be available on Amazon through their like print on demand service. I am holding in my hands right now a proof copy of that. We have found a couple of some minor issues in the formatting, so we went to correct that, and we're going to order another proof. But as soon as this kind of proofs out and we get the Kickstarter stuff shipped, we're going to be putting that up for sale on Amazon too.
Hopefully soon,
very soon, within the next week or two for sure. Price point in that is going to be $15.99, I believe. So you can get the
steal
of
a deal.
It's a steal. It looks good. Like I said, it's cool. It's cool to hold a physical book that I have written part of in my hands, and I'm very proud of the way it turns out, and I can't wait for you guys to see it. So thanks for that question, Steven. And then Janine S., well, regarding the possibility of an audiobook, she wrote in and said, "Aaron, I think you should definitely read an Audible version of the book for yourself, although I thought Anthony sounded great on your most recent podcast. That way we can make fun of you mispronouncing things in our reviews." Well, thank you. Thank you. And we're going to start the audiobook conversion as soon as I physically have time, which is going to be towards the end of December and early January. We did not hit the price point to fund a complete audiobook or a complete Audible version that's going to have like all the fancy whisper sync and stuff, but I am going to make an audiobook version that's like in downloadable MP3 formats that you can play on your phone or your computer or anything available pretty soon. I just have to record it. I had an idea, Anthony.
Okay.
Do you think it'd be cool if like I read the main text and like the footnotes and then I hand it off to you to read like the info boxes and the other different breakouts?
I think we should read every other word. Just take turns on those words.
I think we should harmonize. Like I'll be, you be the alto and I'll be the baritone, and we just, have our dulcet tones combine.
Yeah. Well, I think what's interesting about this book is that each chapter has pretty predictable sections.
Yeah.
Some of those sections I was a primary author for, and some of them you were.
Right.
We could take turns reading sections. Now, you are a professional voice man. So, I think if I was listening to this book, I would much rather listen to you than to me. So, but, and you're the one that made the promise. I haven't made any promises yet.
That's true.
So, you'll figure it out, I'm sure.
Yeah, no. And it's not that I can't. I just thought it'd be an interesting break from eating the bowl full of vanilla ice cream, which is my voice. Like, you throw in a little bit of sherbet. I don't know why. I don't know why I see you as sherbet. But you throw some of there, maybe some strawberry, maybe some Ben and Jerry's Cherry Garcia, and it kind of cleanse the palate, and then you get back into the vanilla. So,
we'll figure something out. That sounds fun.
We want to talk about actual content, some interesting things for you guys from the book, related to the book. And we thought one thing would be fun to do is because in every chapter we do one, sometimes more, character studies, which are deep dives into specific characters and how they relate to the religious, political, myth, histories, theory thing that we're talking about in the various chapters of the book. And I got to pick the first character. So today we're going to talk about everything Tyrion Lannister, especially as it pertains to his views on religion and his skepticism, et cetera, et cetera.
Is Tyrion everyone's favorite character, would you say?
A lot of people like Arya. So
that's true.
But
that's
it's probably, I mean, a lot of people like Jon, a lot of people like Dany, but like, he's got to be your number two at least.
I think you're on safe ground with Tyrion, which I think is why he pops up so often in our little two-volume project. Mm-hmm. I think that we talk about him in the introduction. We talk about him in probably three different chapters and the conclusion, even though he may be the most irreligious of all of the characters.
Yeah. It makes him kind of unique within the world because there's not a lot of atheist skeptics type archetypes. And it's kind of even debatable about how far even along the atheist and agnostic bend he goes into. I just want to tease that topic because there's also something else we wanted to do is read one of our Amazon reviews, because we're trying to encourage people that have read our book and want to say something about it to do so. And Kat left us a very nice review. She says, "The book is a smart and laugh-out-loud guide to both the books and the show. Aaron's humor and insightful commentary translate well to print and are matched by Anthony's own contributions of drollery and scholarly analysis. Their book is both intellectually serious and irreverently fun-loving. The authors blend thought-provoking and substantial discussions of sociology, religion, and history with pop culture references and wry in-jokes in a conversational style that delivers an enlightening and entertaining read. Ardents of George R.R. Martin will gain a deeper understanding of the context and layers of a storytelling, and more casual fans will be drawn in to give the books and or show a more considered look." So again, thank you, Kat, for those very kind words. If you have read our book, either through the Kickstarter, if you bought it on Amazon and would like to give us a review, please, we encourage you to do so. Good or bad, we're taking all critiques of the book, and each one you do actually helps us market it, because the more people that are kind of talking about it and buzzing about it and giving us ratings, the better we do on the Amazon marketplace.
Kat gave us not only a good succinct review, but she used the word drollery.
Mm.
And I think that's lovely.
Top shelf.
Thank you, Kat.
You actually coined my favorite word in this book when we're talking about the let me see if I can understate it so we don't get the usual effect, the Clegane Bowl. You described it as thunder domestically awesome.
Yes. I wrote that.
I love
that. Is pretty good.
Thunder domestically awesome is a great coinage and phrasing, and it should spread throughout the land.
Okay, I thought you were going to, because the one I'm most proud of is Ferengi Eargasm.
Sure.
I think.
You didn't coin that, though.
I didn't? Oh, no.
Well, I mean, yeah, like Ferengis, that's like, they have a word for it. It's umox, you know?
Yeah, it's umox, but eargasms, I just think, is much more descriptive.
Oh, you're right. That's actually the literal translation from the Ferengi.
Right.
So I don't know if you can be credited for coining that, although you are like 400 years early in its coinage, so.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
So, yeah, so because Aeron got to choose the first character, Tyrion, he has to answer five questions that I've come up with. So here's my first question. Aeron, when you are reading A Song of Ice and Fire, do you see Peter Dinklage in your mind? And would you consider this a good or bad thing?
As is usually typical on things where I see the adaptation before I read the book, I do see Tyrion as, when I read him, I do see Peter Dinklage's face. Now, there's a couple times where it's like the books are kind of jarring when they start talking about how ugly he is and how he's kind of hunched over and mismatched eyes. And then, you know, when he gets his nose chopped off, then he's literally like, you know, monstrous. You can see right into his skull hole.
George is not kind to Tyrion
no.
in these ways.
And, you know, obviously Peter Dinklage is a very classically good-looking man. And he also has a melodious, distinguished, powerful speaking voice. Neither of those things the book Tyrion is blessed with. So what about you?
I would say that I probably do see Peter Dinklage most of the time. And I think that I have to remind myself that he's got like platinum hair and mismatched eyes
right.
and half a nose and a huge scar, you know, down his face.
Yeah.
Because every now and again, those are important details for the book. I mean, look, Peter Dinklage is a handsome man and I don't mind that so much.
I find it amazing that people are able to keep that separation because like I found even honestly, a lot of times when I've read a book first and then see the movie and go back and like, for example, Lord of the Rings, perfect example. I had from a young age, very clear ideas of what I thought Gandalf and Frodo and Sam
right.
and Aragorn looked like. And then the movie comes and I'll be damned if I don't see Elijah Wood's giant eyes when when I think of Frodo. And it's
right.
so like I, and I've heard some people like that doesn't ever happen. Like their residual image of these characters is so strong that no amount of Hollywood star power can overwrite that. But I found that historically not to be true. Okay.
All right. So, next question. All right. So do you think Tyrion is a Mary Sue character from Martin? Before you answer, here is the definition of Mary Sue from Grammarist.com. So here I quote. A Mary Sue is a fictional character who is so perfect as to be unrealistic. A Mary Sue is a character who has no weakness, who performs heroically and perfectly in every situation. This sort of character is usually considered to be a form of wish fulfillment on the part of the author and is a sign of an amateur writer.
I don't think so. I think the closest character that you can get to a Mary Sue in the canon for Martin is Sam. Sam Tarly, but even then, he still has flaws. And Sam's flaws in the fact that he's like, I guess his flaws, he's not traditionally masculine in Westeros, in the universe.
That's right.
And he never like turns that into, turns it around in his own head to be like a plus. It's just kind of like, well, it's just the way I am. And, you know, I get what I get. And, but so I don't think any either Sam nor Tyrion is a Mary Sue, especially Tyrion, because my God, he really gets shit on, and he doesn't have the best looks, I don't think, in like Feast and Dance.
I don't think he's perfect, but I think in the ways that maybe Martin would find ideal, I think he may be rhetorically perfect, if you know what I mean. Like, He's always got the witty quip. He's always the smartest guy in the room, and he's got other deficits.
Right.
But in the ways that, you know, sort of the super nerd imagines himself, maybe he's a little idealistic.
Yeah, I mean, but like a true Mary Sue, like a John Galt type, like. Just a person without flaws, because like even though he's very smart, he does. I think like Dance does a good job of exposing him as like privileged. He didn't even realize it because he always thinks he's the most accursed among men. And then he spends significant amount of time with this other dwarf character, Penny, and just realizes how fundamentally she saw the world differently because she's of the small folk. She's not. Not just small folk, but she's, you know, a dwarf on top of that. So she's got, like, all this negative social stigma and all this negative kind of privilege.
If we frame that as, are there certain elements of Martin in Tyrion, I think we'd probably say yes.
Oh, yeah.
But is he a Mary Sue character, I would have to say. I mean, according to this particular definition, which is not probably the only definition you could find, I don't think he is. All right, my next question. Will Tyrion get to ride a dragon?
In the books, I'd give it 50-50, because I think the dragon has three heads is going to be a much bigger deal in the books. In the show, I think, nah. I think that whether George put that in a bullet point that he sent to the Double Ds, and the Double Ds are just like, nah, eject, we're going to do the simple version or what, I just can't see... I mean, hell, there's not even three good dragons to ride at this point in the show's story. So, let alone having three decent heads, I just don't think it's going to be a thing.
Because there's a big deal made about the fact that he was able to design this special saddle so that he was able to ride a horse, right?
Yeah, yeah. I saw, though, like that was like a lot of people were thinking that, yeah, you're right. I mean, that would allow him to ride... You know, even his unconventional form to ride a dragon, or some people thought that would allow Bran to ride a dragon. But I've always been persuaded that if Bran's going to be a dragon rider, it would be like war. He wouldn't be riding on top. He'd be riding inside. He'd be in the cockpit, so to speak. So, so yeah, I guess if I think Martin knows that, right? You know, he's like you won't want to run, or you'll be able to fly. I think that if that saddle engineering was going to foreshadow anything, it would have to be Tyrion. It'd have to be Tyrion. But that's what I'm saying. In the book, I think it's 50-50, with like Dany and Jon being the other most likely nominees.
All right, next question. Is Tyrion an Oedipus type?
So this is interesting. We go into this in volume 2 of Gods of Thrones. It's going to be coming out this spring in 2019. But there are an interesting number of similarities between the two. So let's talk about like the mythical Oedipus, and then we can talk about the Oedipus type, right? So Tyrion, his physicality, he's described as having an abnormal gait, forcing him that waddles to and fro. Whereas Oedipus literally means swollen foot. He had his feet bound, which would create an abnormal gait similar to Tyrion. Tyrion saved King's Landing, but that doesn't save him from being hated. And that compares to Oedipus saving Thebes. Is that how you pronounce Thebes?
So I would say Thebes, but I've studied Greek, so I'm going to say it wrong. I'm sure that this is probably me bringing Koine Greek, and I should be saying this in classical Greek.
So it's Thebes. Oedipus saves the city, but that doesn't save him from being hated by the people. Tyrion, of course, famously disowned by his father Tywin, who contemplates infanticide. And Oedipus is disowned by his father, who also attempts infanticide. Then, of course, the big similarity, Tyrion kills his father Tywin, and Oedipus kills his father as well. So there's a lot of interesting parallels there. Now, if you want to go in a really fun direction, and again, we get way more into this in Volume 2 that's coming out this spring. Freud kind of made the Oedipus complex famous, and that's defined as a male child's unconscious desire for the exclusive love of his mother. This desire includes a jealousy towards the father and an unconscious wish for that parent's death, as well as the unconscious desire for sexual intercourse with the mother. Now, there's no evidence in the book that Tyrion thinks that his mother, Joanna Lannister, is hot and that he wanted to have sex with her because she died in childbirth. But there's actually a crazy but pretty cool theory that involves Tyrion being a secret Targaryen. And there's a ton of different theories about Tyrion being a secret Targaryen. But this one is by way of womb-based, blood magic-fueled time travel. That short form of the theory is that Tyrion is actually the child that was inside Dany, that when
Miri Mazdur
goes into the tent,
something horrible happens to the child. By the way, this is my favorite theory, which is why I asked you this question. I was hoping you'd wind up here.
Yeah, so that actually sends Tyrion from the womb of Dany to the womb of Joanna Lannister, and simultaneously brings the dead fetus that died inside Joanna inside Dany. And there are a lot of interesting connections between the appearance of Dany's dead child and Tyrion's stated appearance when he was born. And it's, like I said, it's crazy, and it's probably not true at all, but it's one of those things where it's got surprising amount of textual evidence, and people have really run with it. So if you want to get more in that, check out the Volume 2 in the spring.
Clearly, we're out on a really, really, really thin ice here, but let's imagine that Tyrion is the child, the time-traveling child of Dany. Well, at the end of this last season, you got this little hint that Tyrion is in love with Dany,
mm-hmm.
and maybe a little bit jealous of Jon during the boat sex episode. So there you go. There's your connection. There's your Oedipal complex.
Yeah, if you want to interpret that knowing look. So
I do think that Dinklage has said his interpretation of that scene is that he's fallen in love with Dany and he's disappointed that she's getting it on with
Jon Snow. Oh, well, what the hell
John
does he
Snow.
Know? What the hell does he know?
He doesn't know anything.
So I, if you listen to the podcast, like I go pretty far against. I think that's just he is the Secretary of State and he's seeing his president. And I don't know. I've lost the plot on this. Fuck a king.
So in this analogy, Jon Snow is Marilyn Monroe. That's what you're saying?
Yeah, something like that. Or it's more of like you don't want your head of state being emotionally compromised by a relationship with a key ally. And that's concern about the political ramifications of this. Or maybe he's a traitor, or maybe he's jealous of Dany. Who knows? Dany does seem to inspire no shortage of jealousy in the men that find themselves surrounding her.
All right, question number 5, and this will do it for the questions to you. Will Tyrion be alive and well at the end of A Dream of Spring?
Yes. Yes. And I have nothing to base that on other than I think that one or both of Jon and Dany are going to die. And I just don't buy that he's going to make a clean sweep of all those fan favorites. Now, George is probably steepling his fingers and saying, in response to that. But that's my gut feeling. I feel like Tyrion, he is one of the survive. Him and Sansa, I think, are the closest to locks of surviving this shithole situation. What do you think?
I remember. I think Jim is on the record having promised that if Tyrion dies, he's done.
Well, I hope that happens on a very last episode, at least.
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I mean, look, it's very possible that Tyrion could bite it. He could die a grisly, meaningless death. It could happen. You know, who knows? Who knows what Martin will do? Is he integral to the end game is the question. Mm-hmm. I think he's probably integral to Dany's Westerosi conquest. Mm-hmm. But the end game isn't the Westerosi conquest. The end game is what to do about the others. I'm not sure. I think Sam is maybe more integral to that war. So yeah. I don't know. He could die. He could easily.
Well, die. You know, I've also been a big proponent of some version of democracy breaking out in Westeros as a bittersweet ending to the Song of Ice and Fire, and I do a deep dive of that in this book, this Dream of Democracy kind of fan theory.
Volume 1, last chapter, you get to full-throated argument for Westerosi proto-democracy.
And I think that Tyrion has been trained throughout this entire series to be this prime minister type figure. And it seems like he's kind of born to be the post-royalty, like the post-royal supremacy, that prime minister type figure. Everything has been training him for this moment and teaching him how to wield power and humility and service and all those things. So I think that also that fits in with my theory. So
I'm gonna back it. He would make a perfect Hand of the King.
Which
we've already seen, right? We've already
and the
seen
king if the king was just like a figurehead, like a Bobby Baratheon type character,
right?
You know, he's going to lead the melees and the tournaments and outdrink everybody in the realm and leave the stewardship of the realm to smarter, better men. We now move on to the next phase of our deep dive, where we're going to read a portion of the canon and then explain why we selected it and have a little discussion on that. Anthony, would you like to...
Yes, I would.
Tell us about your passage.
Yeah, so this is just a couple paragraphs here from Game, and I think it is one of Jon Snow's first POVs. Few chapters.
Yeah.
Yeah, POV chapters. So here it goes. "Boy," a voice called out to him. Jon turned. Tyrion Lannister was sitting on the ledge above the door to the Great Hall, looking for all the world like a gargoyle. The dwarf grinned down at him. "Is that animal a wolf?" "A dire wolf," Jon said. His name was Ghost. He stared up at the little man, his disappointment suddenly forgotten. "What are you doing up there? Why aren't you at the feast?" "Too hot, too noisy, and I drunk too much wine," the dwarf told him. "I learned long ago that it is considered rude to vomit on your brother. Might I have a closer look at your wolf?" John hesitated, then nodded slowly. "Can you climb down, or shall I bring a ladder?" "Oh, bleed that," the little man said. He pushed himself off the ledge into empty air. John gasped and then watched in awe as Tyrion Lannister spun round in a tight ball, landed lightly on his hands, and then vaulted backward onto his legs. Okay, so I picked this for a few reasons. The first reason is that Tyrion always gets the best dialogue. He always gets the best dialogue. In fact, I think that he has this sort of... if you were going to sum up Tyrion's persona early on, it's kind of this wounded character who's pretty self-aware, who has got it all figured out. And so I love this sort of early exchange with he and Jon Snow. The second... Yeah, this, oh, and you this, also get this, to learn he, about... Go ahead.
he's got this like Oscar Wilde way of self-deprecating humor that also makes him seem badass.
Yes.
Like,
he is,
hey,
Oscar
Wilde. I'm drunk, but I've considered long ago that it's rude to vomit on your brother. And, you know, it's, he's saying that he has, in fact, puked on Jaime Lannister, who is one of the biggest badasses of all the kingdom, and he can do that because he's Tyrion. And that's a pretty good humble brag, you know?
So, yeah, so you've got, right. So you've got him joking, you've got him sort of, you know, self-effacing, you've got him drunk. So you've got all of Tyrion here.
Mm-hmm,
But and then eventually in this chapter, he's going to teach this lesson about sort of being less than ideal in your father's eyes to Jon Snow. But I picked this also for another reason, because Martin has said that this is one of the most regrettable things he's written.
Hmm.
Have you seen this?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so he's George Martin has said he really sort of wishes that he didn't do this to Tyrion, this whole acrobatic thing, because he basically, you know, he basically introduces Tyrion as a sort of almost circus character. And you know, it's a little bit much. It's a little bit much. And so George has basically said, I wish I could take that back. But this is out of his hands. This is now part of the canon that's in the world. It's now the property of all of us. And it doesn't matter if George wants to take this back. He's not going to Lucas this thing. This is part of Tyrion's early reveals.
So I picked my passage from A Dance with Dragons. It's the 9th Tyrion POV chapter. It's the 4th. I chose it because I knew which passage you were going to read, but I didn't know why you read it. So I thought it would dovetail nicely with that. And it's now super interesting because the context is a knight whose nickname is Duck has been knocked off into the river off of a boat. And Tyrion is teasing him about, I thought a duck would swim better than that. So the knight then pushes him back in the water. And after he gets out and he gets back on the boat, he says, "You're not the first to try and drown me," he told Duck as he was pouring river water from his boot. "My father threw me down a well the day I was born, but I was so ugly the water witch who lived down there spat me back." He pulled off the other boot, then did a cartwheel along the deck, spraying all of them. Young Griff laughed. "Where did you learn that?" "The mummers taught me," he lied. "My mother loved me best of all her children because I was small. She nursed me at her breast till I was 7. That made my brothers jealous, so they stuffed me in a sack and sold me to a mummer's troop. When I tried to run off, the master mummer cut off half my nose, so I had no choice but to go with them and learn to be amusing." The truth was rather different. His uncle had taught him a bit of tumbling when he was 6 or 7. Tyrion had taken to it eagerly. For half a year, he had cartwheeled his merry way around Casterly Rock, bringing smiles to the faces of septon, squires, and servants alike. Even Cersei laughed to see him once or twice. All that ended abruptly the day his father returned from his sojourn in King's Landing. That night at supper, Tyrion surprised his sire by walking the length of the high table on his hands. Lord Tywin was not pleased. "The gods made you a dwarf. Must you be a fool as well? You were born a lion, not a monkey." "And you're a corpse, father, so I'll caper as I please." "You have a gift for making men smile," Septa Lamora told Tyrion as he was drying off his toes. "You should thank the father above. He gives gifts to all his children." "He does," he agreed pleasantly. "And when I die, please let them bury me with a crossbow so I can thank the father above for his gifts the same way I thank the father below." So, two reasons I picked this. One is that I thought it dovetailed nicely with your discussion of a choice of Tyrion showing acrobatics. And I think it's even more interesting because if George thinks that's his greatest mistake, it's kind of funny that he doubles down on it in his most recent book. Like, he could have just... that could have been a one-off affectation, but he's now hanging further character moments on it. Do you think there's a little schizophrenia there with George and how he feels about it? Or
no, I think once the book is published...
In for a penny, in for a pound?
Yeah, once the book is published, it doesn't really belong to you anymore. And so you're constricted to what you've got in writing out there, and so you might as well build on it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, maybe so. Maybe someone was sort of grilling him during the interview, and he just started talking, and something came out of his mouth.
I have to say something. What will people not kill me for? I know. Tumbling. they're not gonna. They surely won't go after me about tumbling on Tumblr. Do you think the other thing that I wanted to kind of use as a springboard on is that, you know, in our chapter about the skeptics and the faithless, which is kind of a talks about Tyrion, it talks about the Hound. You talk about Tyrion, and you know he's the closest we have to like maybe an atheist, an agnostic, certainly a skeptic in the book. But even he makes show of, you know, telling Joffrey, for example, that he should pray for Bran's soul or whatever. You know, express his prayers to the Starks. That he even like he might be skeptical of the gods, but he is a man who lives in society that's just perfused with religion. There isn't like a skeptic class. There aren't people that really identify as atheists.
Right. So I mean, you do have examples of atheists in the ancient world, but it doesn't mean what we think it means today. They're like Diogenes was thought of as atheist, and he was exiled. But in that culture, it meant godless, and it was because he was making fun of the gods, not because he was expressing sort of a modern, you know, disbelief in sort of a closed universe and an embrace of scientific study or anything like that. Right. He was called godless because he was making fun of the gods. And it was probably related to something along the lines of, yeah, well, if they're going to strike me down, then they would have done it already. so maybe he's saying something like that. Well, you get to hear Tyrion say that a lot. And he's always making jokes and whatnot. But I think that Tyrion does have some kind of sort of default position, religious default position, sort of deep down. I was listening to an interview with John Mulaney on NPR, and they were asking him, so you grew up Catholic, so would you still consider yourself Catholic? And what he said was, some of it snuck in before the garage door shut. So, and I think that there may be something like that going on with the Lannister kids, because at one point Jaime says that he's always sort of respected the warrior the most, and Cersei does not want to have sex in the Great Sept because it would be dishonorable to the gods. And Tyrion, after he kills his father, he's on this boat and he's getting drunk. This is the beginning of Dance. Mm-hmm. And he associates the storm that's coming with sort of the wrath of his own father, who's probably in some kind of communion with the father above. And then later on, when he wants to commit suicide, he's looking at these seven poisonous mushrooms, and he's thinking that the seven are sort of trying to hint to him that he should take his own life. And so I think when he's stripped down, like really raw, and Tyrion is sort of at his most, raw and without pretense, there's sort of this unpredictable faith of the seven that snuck in there before the garage door shut.
We never actually talked about this, but as we talked about last episode, like I grew up in a very fundamentalist religion, and now I identify as an atheist. But I'd be lying if I wouldn't say that one of my first thoughts when there's a particularly apocalyptic event that happens on planet Earth and does seem to be happening more frequently of late than I'd like, one of the first thoughts in the back of my mind is, you might be wrong about the whole Armageddon thing. In times of like really stress or scary things, like I'm tempted to run home to mama, kind of. And I wonder if like it's like I kind of relate to Tyrion, that like on his best day he's like, yeah, whatever, you know, gods of tits and wine, yeah. But you know, when he's done something really bad and the storm clouds are on the horizon, ooh, those seven hells, I wonder if there's really seven of them.
Okay, so I have two questions.
Uh-huh.
First off, I like the Hunt for Red October reference there, and I want to know if it was conscious.
Oh, I'm an old school Tom Clancy fan, man.
Okay.
Of course.
All right. Okay.
Of course.
So I'm glad.
I even did it with the inflection.
that's why it was recognizable. Yeah, yeah. What was the onboard navigation system?
The sonar of the Dallas. Because the sonar system used to be like a NOAA oceanic survey kind of software. And he's like, when it doesn't know what to do, it likes to run home to mama. So,
all right. So yeah. So that was my first question. But and you definitely gave the right answer. All right. So the second question is this: would you say that the God that you disbelieve in is the Christian God?
Nah. I mean, I started there for sure. It's kind of been a journey. I didn't go right from fundamentalist Christian to atheist. There's a couple way stops along the way. I went from fundamentalist Christian to deist to maybe in a personal force intelligence of the universe to agnostic to, honestly, I call myself an apathist today. It's like, I don't, if there's a God, he knows where to find me. He's got the power to make that connection happen. Else I'm going to go on with my life, because I've spent a lot of my life thinking about him.
There's a lot to unpack there. We'll definitely need to work through some of that.
Like, when all this is over, I would love to have a religious conversation with you.
Yeah, well, we'll do that.
I don't know if we release that as bonus content, because I don't know anyone that would care. Like, everyone would care about it, but I bet there's some people that care about it.
I'm hoping that we'll be really drunk at the time.
I can definitely make that happen.
So I'd put it a different way. So if you, when you are, it's not like there's ever a sort of a moment where you're thinking, oh crap, Allah is, might be real.
Yeah, Yahweh.
Yeah, I mean, the belief in Brahman or some other religious system, that was never a part of your DNA.
No.
So there's a sense in which your Christianity still informs your atheism.
Oh, for sure. I was about to say I think I got a pretty secular humanist outlook now, but absolutely. There's no way I could say with a straight face that Judeo-Christian morality doesn't inform my moral and ethical framework to some extent.
I don't know how we got there, man, but that was,
I don't either.
That's probably more of what we should be doing.
Like, when we're done with Fire and Blood, we're going to have a bonus podcast, and you and I are just going to drink scotch or whatever your fave is, and talk religion.
All right, so this is the next section, all right? So this is sort of the character development section, and this is where we talk about stages, trajectories, or transformations of the character.
Let's talk about some key events before we start talking about trajectories and stages. The key events that formed Tyrion's life and are fundamental to his character. And we talked about this before the podcast, and we've identified death of his first wife, betrayal by his father, and meeting Dany. And I kind of wanted to talk about a lot of those things, but one thing I might differ from you is the betrayal by his father, because I feel like the thing that really wounded him is the betrayal by Shay. That's the one that like really gets him, because like in Dance, he's not dwelling on where fathers go or trying to find his fathers.
Sure.
Instead, he's the thing that echoes in his mind is, you know, where do whores go? Because he's always thinking about that first woman who was revealed in the end of that season by Jaime. Well, no, not on the. This is kind of like a book only thing. The show establishes that he had this wife and tells the story about that Jaime. This was a trick that he played on Tyrion, and he paid a whore to have sex with him. And then his father found out about it. And he paid all the Lannister men to have sex with this woman, and they tipped her a silver stag. And then Tyrion went last, and he tipped a gold coin, a gold dragon, just so everyone knows that the Lannisters are better. And, you know, Tyrion was very bitter because he's like, how foolish I was to think that this woman would ever love me. And then you find out.
In the books, this is Tysha, right? Or Tysha. I'm not sure how to pronounce that.
I'd say it's Tysha because that's how all the other. Well, I guess not. It could be Tysha.
We say Tywin. So we might say Tysha. So yeah, so he was in love. This was his first love, and mm-hmm. and they were legitimately married. And mm-hmm. I'm not clear. It seems to me that there's two narratives. One is that she was a prostitute that Jamie paid to act like she was.
Right. That's really the official in love with story. Him. But what Jamie confides in him when he releases him from the black cells is that actually she was true blue. She actually was exactly who she said she was, that our father just thought that she only loved you because she wanted to marry into the Lannister name, and he wanted to dissuade that and humiliate her and humiliate you, and there was this whole charade, which enraged Tyrion and what leads to his father's death. But I think it's interesting, too, because there's a duality there that when Shae betrayed him, you got Tyrion's first love, his wife Tysha, who was revealed, who he thought was a whore, but was revealed to be a genuinely sweet girl who loved him on his merits. And she was kind of forced to play that other role, whereas Shae was revealed to be an actual whore, or prostitute, or sex. I'm not trying to be offensive. I'm just using the parlance of the realm. Who plays a genuinely sweet girl who loves him on his merits. So I think the twin realizations of Shae being who she is versus who she thought he was versus Tysha, that his actual wife, and my God, imagine learning that so many years later, is the thing that really, like, that messes him up way more than the fact that he put a crossbolt bolt through his father's guts, I think.
So this is sort of a long, convoluted way to say that the betrayal by Shae is every bit as important as sort of pushing Tyrion toward this suicidal state, mm-hmm. where he starts, you know, wandering Essos thinking, where do whores go, right? So
right.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. That probably has some sort of psychological leverage over him.
Right. Especially since, like, the other thing is, like, I feel like we in the Phantom soft pedal this a lot, but he strangled his lover to death. Granted, it was a sexual betrayal, a personal betrayal, but still, I don't think you can do that, like, as a guy like Tyrion and not have it deeply disturb you psychologically.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, and I would defy anyone to read Tyrion's first POV chapter in Dance and look at the way Tyrion is dealing with basically the sex slave.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, he's just a total asshole.
Yeah,
When I was first reading it, I thought, okay, here's Martin. Here he goes again. He's going to take a character who I thought one way about, and he's going to send him this character mm-hmm. on this dark trajectory, in the same way that sort of Jamie has come up from being a villain to something of an empathetic character.
Right.
Maybe Tyrion is on his way to becoming sort of this darker character.
He's the anti-Jamie.
I don't think that Martin can quite do that with Tyrion. I'm not sure.
Now, are you... I don't know if you've ever talked about this, but are you familiar with the sailor's wife theory?
I am not.
So, in the books, there is a prostitute that works over in the Happy Port brothel in Braavos. Okay. And this kind of dovetails to Tyrion wondering, you know, where do whores go? Where do whores go? And thinking that, like, you know, maybe he will find his wife somewhere. The sailor's wife, her real name is unknown, but she's called the sailor's wife because she only beds those who marry her. She's very particular that she'll only have sex with a man who she's married to. And humorously, she sometimes marries multiple times per night, you know, because she is a sex worker. She's generous, quick to laugh, but there's a fundamental underlying sadness about this character. And the idea is that her daughter is named Lana, which is a feminine form of the name Lan, which is where the Lannister's name is derived from, Lan the Clever. And her daughter has golden hair, which is, of course, a Lannister trait. And people speculated that this sailor's wife is actually Tysha, because Lana's the right age to be the daughter from her and Tyrion's marriage. She states that she was the same age as Lana now when she gave birth to her, which would put her right in that early teenage that Tyrion claims that she was. And the fact that she's now working in a whorehouse supports the Tywin Lannister quote that she went wherever whores go. So, again, this is like early stages of this theory, because this is material from largely Arya's chapters. But it is interesting. There is the dates and times line up. The dates and times line up.
And the marriage theme.
The marriage theme. The fact that would be... That would be something that would wound her so much that it becomes like a tick, you know. Right. That experience of being gang raped by Lannisters right after you got married to one would be something that would maybe skew your version, your vision of what marriage should be. But I think it's a neat theory. Definitely not going to happen in the show, because the show didn't even bother with the twist. But the book, something to look out for in the books.
Yeah, no, Martin seems to be really, really interested in Tyrion's sort of dark ruminations about where whores go.
Yeah.
So it would be interesting if that doesn't get paid off in the books, you know, somehow. Tyrion has dwelt so long on Tysha that not to sort of ever round that out, even if it's sort of to reveal that she died a long time ago or something. I think it would be sort of a unresolved issue if Tysha doesn't come back into the picture somehow.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Are there does Tyrion have stages?
He's got stages like an Atlas rocket, sure.
So you already mentioned like the Oscar Wilde stage, right?
Right.
And I think that's probably a distinct, like when you and Jim were doing season 3 recap, which you just recently did, the rewatch. I remember hearing the phrase peak Tyrion a lot, right? So what do you mean by peak Tyrion?
I think peak Tyrion is like him strolling in at the beginning of season 2 and you just dropping the, hey, by the way, I'm Hand of the King, and I have been sent here with specific orders to bring you, my idiot nephew, and you, my idiot sister, to heal. And I'm going to do that. Yeah. And I've got this thing that says it's from Tywin, so no one's going to give me shit about it, not even your Kingsguard. Like, that's Tyrion when he's got political capital to flex to match his intellect is peak Tyrion. Yeah. Peak Tyrion is exemplified by the way he sends Janos Slynt to the wall, the treacherous gold cloak that was one of the ones instrumental in cutting off Ned Stark's head. Like, you know, when the guy's like, how dare you besmirch my honor? He's like, I don't question it. I just deny its existence utterly. He's just, not only is he putting a black bag over the guy's head and making him disappear, but he's doing it in style. That's peak Tyrion.
That's right. So he's three steps ahead of everyone, almost everyone, but he's three steps of at least Janos Slynt for sure. Mm-hmm. But he also has great one-liners as he's sort of bagging the dude and sending him north.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good description of peak Tyrion. So, what next? Other stages of Tyrion?
So, if we want to go in like order, cuz you know, we've got if we pre-discussed this, there is the like you described him as the hedonist smack-talking Tyrion. So this is the Tyrion that slaps Joffrey around because he's not king. And he is pissing off the wall, and he's trying to drink all the Black Brothers under the table.
Yeah, he's gallivanting. He's got no real responsibility at this point, right?
Yeah, and he's the type, he has no real power or responsibilities, but he will, at his trial for his life, make a whole bunch of masturbation jokes and a whole bunch of false confessions and make a mockery of the whole thing. But he's got, you know, Hand of the King would just send in the gold cloaks and the Lannister guard and shut his trial all down. But he can't actually do that. So that's kind of like his proto stage, where he hasn't been given any real power to wield. He just knows he's smarter than everybody wielding the power currently.
Right. So I think there may be a transition when he meets the hill people or the hill tribes and Shaga with his axes and whatnot.
Yeah.
Where he's actually able to talk his way out of first he talks his way out of going through the moon door.
Right.
And then he talks his way out of being cut in half by the by Shaga.
Yeah, and then builds a coalition.
Right. And then his father sends him to King's Landing, and I think at that point it's sort of like he's been recognized as someone who is pretty smart and probably would be good to have around King's Landing if Tywin can't be there, right? And so then you got Peak Tyrion. Then what else? Then we have the Tyrion married to Sansa. Would that be a distinct stage?
No, I'd say that, like, he's got a... So there's a transition period where he flames out his hand and his father comes, takes power, but he, you know, has not... He's still got the spirit to fight, and that pretty much gets broken when he finds out about the betrayal of his brother back with his first wife, which we could talk about Tysha and how that was a formative member of his life. And then throughout the rest, he fundamentally changed, and he's a much darker, more bitter, more cynical, fatalistic character.
Right, so that's him suicidal in Pentos, right? So
yeah,
when he's suicidal in Pentos, it's almost like he is preoccupied with this period of his life that we never heard narrated, because he's with his, you know, he's young, he's in love, he's with his first wife, the Crofter's daughter, and this was sort of like. He's got these memories that are haunting him, and he's kind of sort of reverts to those memories and sort of broods on those as he's suicidal. But okay, so the character that we have not met in the books yet is, I think, the sort of the least interesting Tyrion, the sort of the season 7 Tyrion, who's this Hand of the Queen.
Yeah.
And he makes interesting mistakes, I guess, politically. But he's just not as fun.
Yeah.
He's not cartwheeling. He's not slapping Joffrey. We want a fun, cartwheeling, Joffrey-slapping Tyrion. That's what we want.
Yeah, he's not having much fun in trying to keep Dany from burning the King's Landing and trying to... He's like the check on her worst impulses, but he can't slap her, you know, because she's got the dragons.
Well, he's matured in a number of ways.
True, that too.
He's matured, and we're all the worst for it.
So we should talk now about this transformation, which is a topic that we talk about. You know, Tyrion is a big part of this book, but he's also features prominently in Volume 2, which we're still in the process of writing, that he is converted to this so-called dragon's cult. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
This is kind of – I find this really interesting because – when we first meet Tyrion, one of the first things we know about him from Jon's point of view is that he's reading this book, and he's just insatiable when it comes to reading material, and he's especially interested in dragon lore. So the show plays on this a little bit. This is not a book detail, but the show likes to play up this idea that when he was little, he wanted a dragon. It doesn't have to be a big dragon. It could be small like him. but Tyrion, when you get to Tyrion's POV chapters, he is like an encyclopedia when it comes to dragons. And in fact, his famous line, I drink and know things, this was in a conversation about Dany's dragons and how to properly... you know, I don't know, befriend them, I suppose. So I think that Tyrion is sort of never comfortably fits within the religion of his birth, which would be Faith of the Seven. And he's primed to sort of fall in this force of gravity that is Daenerys Targaryen. And if you viewed Dany as something of a cult of personality, who sort of has created this political and ritualistic world around dragon magic, which is basically what the Targaryens have done, then Tyrion is primed to kind of become something of a high priest for this dragon cult. Now, I mean, I'm using that kind of tongue in cheek here. You know, clearly Tyrion's not he's a god of tits and wine. He's not he's not the high priest for anything. But Martin's dropped several clues throughout that Tyrion is the perfect sort of mediator between this dragon magic that's gone from the world and Westeros, which he knows intimately. And so that's what priests do. Priests mediate between the magic or the oracle and the regular person.
Yeah, I mean, you're using terms like cult of personality about Dany, but I think we should back up and actually talk about, because for people that are show-only watchers, the Targaryens, who are Valyrians, they had a no-joke dragon cult back in old Valyria, where a lot of their gods, a lot of the Targaryen dragons were named after their gods, and presumably those gods were, you know, dragon in some sort of form. We don't know a lot about that. Hopefully Fire and Blood illuminates that. But also, you know, the Targaryens considered themselves dragons incarnate.
So, so there's different Targaryen approaches to this. Some are like true believers, they really want to try to become a dragon,
right? To the extent that they try to drink wildfire and immolate themselves, thinking that's going to bring about the literal transformation.
And then you've got sort of more politically savvy Targaryens, like Aegon Targaryen, who conquers Westeros, and he's figured out that religion is a political tool, and he's pretty happy just to adopt the faith of the Seven. Because it's going to sort of smooth his acceptance in Westeros.
Right.
So it's almost like the Targaryen cult, dragon cult, is fundamentally a political conquest and a tool of political conquest. But every now and again, you get these true believers that come along and they sort of have merged this ancient lore and the rituals and the patriarchal figures and everything that you'd find in a religion, you find with some of these Targaryen crazies.
And there's certainly with Dany, there's some of that, if not in fact, in spirit, because she does see herself as destined, and she does see, she's very much aware of the blood of Valyria flowing through her and the lineage that she comes from, and that these are, she calls herself the mother of dragons, which, like begats like. So she must consider herself something of a dragon. We know her brother considered herself a dragon.
Clearly, she has some sort of monopoly
mystique
on this particular kind of dragon magic.
Yeah.
And There's a great little scene in this last season 7, where she says, she's talking about her character and where she's come from, and she says, I don't have faith. I don't have faith in any gods, but I have faith in myself. And it's almost like, yeah, of course, that's what that's what dictators say. And I think that's exactly what Varys and Tyrion are worried about. Like, can she be trusted? Do we have another mad king on our hands? Is she the kind of person who elevates herself above sort of the ethics of common people? And I think that Tyrion, in so much as she has faith in herself, I think that Tyrion also expresses faith in her specifically, right? For all intents and purposes, Dany has become Tyrion's god placement, god figure.
Okay, let's get into some feedback. We got a little bit of it. You can send it to gameofthrones@baldmove.com if you've got some questions or comments on this book review series that we're doing, or you can get on our forums. There's a thread on it, forums.baldmove.com. First up, Janine. Just brought your book and or just bought your book rather and sat down and consumed it this afternoon. It was a fun and fascinating and yes, easy read. I especially liked the discussion of guest rights and tribes and how behavior expected and taken for granted in one tribe can be manipulated or even summarily dismissed in another without sending a memo. What I truly love about the book is the way you both write together, going from fairly meaty philosophical and historical material to 80s pop culture references, often in the same sentence. I'm definitely looking forward to the second volume. Again, excellent job. You'll have to describe some of these incredible illustrations for those of us who can't see them. I'm sure I'm not the only blind person buying your book, right? Let me strong arm a few of my friends then. So thank you for buying that, Janine, and I can't wait to get you the audiobook version. But if you want, she's alluding to these are incredible illustrations. We had Chase Stone, who is a highly regarded and sought after fantasy illustrator. He did a lot of the original art on the actual official World of Ice and Fire book for George Martin. And he did a great job, you know, with our cover that depicts a band of the First Men setting fire to one of the sacred weirwood trees of the children. And then we wanted him to kind of illustrate some of these fan theories, because they're some of the funner parts, more fun parts, the popcorn parts of our books. And it's also something that doesn't get depicted. It's not like officially depicted in any kind of HBO way or anything that would get us sued kind of way. So there's two illustrations. One is an illustration of the Roose is Loose or the Bolt-On theory, which postulates that Roose Bolton is a vampire. It's a crazy theory. It's one of my favorites, and you can read all about it in Volume 1. But it depicts Roose essentially full-blown as a vampire attacking an ancient Stark King's retinue at night, like thousands of years ago. And he's being opposed by a warged-in direwolf, and it's just badass. He uses book-accurate descriptions of Roose Bolton's personal armor, and we found some details of, like, these screaming faces they're on as, like, pauldrons or whatever, and it just looks badass. And then he also illustrated the Clegane Bowl. And one of my favorite details of that picture is there's the thunder domestically awesome, the conflict happening in the foreground. But in the background, you see just as like this subtle detail is there's this row after row of these guys blowing these official royal looking horns. But they also look very much like the vuvuzelas or the air horns you hear every time you talk about the Clegane Bowl. And I thought that was pretty fun. So one of the prime reasons to buy the book is to see the awesome artwork by Chase Stone. Moving on to Lauren, I really enjoy reading God of Thrones. I love how the book keeps a pretty consistent funny tone while explaining the theology. It definitely makes for a readable book. I went to a Jesuit college and would have loved to have to read something like Gods of Thrones in one of my theology classes. I have a few questions for you and Anthony as I was reading the book. One, religion plays such a big part of Game of Thrones, but it doesn't seem like one religion will quote-unquote win in the end. Dany seems pretty agnostic in terms of religious beliefs, and Jon is obviously team old gods. Even their advisors, if they all live to the end, aren't specific in their beliefs. Do you agree or disagree?
Okay, so here's one of the things I love about Martin's world is that it seems authentically pluralistic, which I think that maybe he does better than any other fantasy writer I've ever encountered. So there are a lot of religions represented. Will one win in the end? You're probably right. One religion, doubtful, Lauren, that any one religion will win. And I think that if you look at sort of a lot of these ancient empires, they figure out how to let the locals continue to worship how they want to worship, and sort of either incorporate that into their own religion or just sort of add their own gods to the local gods. And almost everyone seems fine with that. And every now and again, you'll get a people group that doesn't take too kindly to that. And so maybe one god needs to win. But I think that if indeed, Aeron is correct that there is some sort of proto-democracy in Dream of Spring, then these folks are going to have to figure out how to live with religious pluralism in a way that doesn't create war after war after war.
So I'm going to zig a little bit where you zagged, and I think that R'hllor looks like it's going to be looking real good post post Dream of Spring.
So it's gonna do. R'hllor is gonna take over in the same way that the Andals.
Yeah, brought, it's gonna be a dominant religion, and because they've backed the right horse, like Dany or part of her coalition is going to win. It's gonna be and it's gonna be on the back of the dragons. And that's going to be the prophecy confirmed. And I'm not like, I think you're right that the land will continue to kind of support a plurality of religions, but, and they're going to have to do like, so saith the old gods and the new gods and the next generation gods, or like,
but R'hllor looks like the most likely to dominate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But like, it's going to be the ascendant, just because, again, I think that's going to carry a lot of weight to small folk that, hey, there's a religion that backed Dany and her dragons and worships fire, and dragons are fire made flesh. Yeah, that makes sense. What have the seven done for us lately? So,
right.
Next up, since we are going to be seeing more of the creation and beginnings of the White Walkers during the Long Night, and I think she's referencing the working title for the new HBO prequel to this. Do you think that they might explore more of the culture that you reference in the book?
Boy, I hope so. if you're gonna criticize Martin on anything, it's got to be that these big baddies coming from the lands of always winter. They're pretty one-dimensional characters.
Yeah,
so far,
and exactly anyway. the kind of way that he professes not to traffic in.
Right. Yeah. No. They're every bit. Well, maybe we'll learn more about their culture and their backstory and their motives. That would be nice.
It'd be a nice out for him if they are pretty thinly sketched in the book, but then the prequel fills out all of their details and makes them into the complex villains that. He saved all of his complexity for the Lannisters, and he had to move the complexity of the White Walker motivations to the prequel series.
So I just saw an interview with him, but he basically confirmed that the White Walkers do in fact represent climate change.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit skeptical. Like, yeah, I could.
I think he's backed into that.
Are you sure that's what?
I think he's backed into that one, honestly.
Yeah. He may be sort of strip mining past intentions. But if that's the case, and he is the author, climate change doesn't have a motive. It's just going to kill us all, you know?
Yeah, it's an impersonal force, right?
It's pretty impersonal.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. Good question, though.
Finally, if you lived in Westeros, what religion do you think you would lean towards and why?
Okay, you go first.
I think I would probably roll with the Faith of the Seven because it doesn't seem like it seems like it has the least amount of ritual. There's no human sacrifice that I've seen. The maesters seem to like it, and that appeals to my rational kind of science-based it has their official kind of blessing. That's probably how I'd roll. I'd be like Tyrion. Yeah. I wouldn't maybe not believe it and think that there's probably a lot more to the story, but yeah, there's probably some kind of number of gods and they have some number of hells and they may or may not care exactly what I'm doing right this minute, but they're up there and doing their thing. What about you?
I think that the historically plausible answer is that I would be whatever faith I was born into.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you do have characters like Tyrion who are primed to sort of convert, or Arya. You could say Arya is in a sense converted. But 99.9% of people in the ancient worlds, they're not choosing religion. They're born into it. And so if I was born in Lazar, I would probably worship the Great Shepherd, you know?
See, I thought for sure as a, you know, like I said, we never talked about the religion, but I presume that you're nominally a Christian of some flavor.
I am a mainline Protestant, yes.
That I thought that would fit you hand in glove. Cause like my personal theory of the Lamb Men, is that they're essentially like these pastoral gods from the land of Canaan, but they never, for whatever reason, they never got that second stage boost into onto the world scene. So they're still, you know, Elohim is over there kind of toiling in obscurity. Whereas the, you know, Faith of the Seven and the old gods and stuff have kind of ran wild, but it does seem...
I guess that's a good question. I don't know that I'll be honest. There is a part of me that is attracted to the religion where nothing happens. So the Faith of the Seven, really nothing happens. I mean, they're there for your name day, and they help you get married, and they'll put, you know, coins or stones over your eyes when you die. And that's about what I'm comfortable with. I don't know if I want a dynamic in your face, you know, God of Fire that's requiring me to, you know, hit the, you know, murder people and get murdered. I don't want that. So, I think I would probably be attracted to something a little bit more pastoral.
Yeah. It's like you know, God that kind of like loves and cuddles you and shepherds you. That sounds nice. Nice.
Okay.
Like to be all right. Taken into that God's bosom.
So yeah, no, I think that's maybe we will develop this a little bit more in that sort of post pod get real about religion podcast we've been talking about.
Indeed, I feel like we've almost promised it at this point. So yeah. That's the podcast for this week. Thank you again for tuning in. We're going to be talking about Gods of Thrones for another couple weeks, but November 20th, George is dropping the bomb, Fire and Blood. We'll be talking about that. Please go on Amazon and buy our book. If any of this stuff sounds interesting, or if you want to hear more, if you want more Game of Thrones in your life, and who really doesn't at this stage, check it out on Amazon. You can buy the digital copy for $9.99 right now, and the paperback is coming out within a week or so. Check that out, and please leave us ratings and reviews on Amazon. The link is right here in the show notes. It makes it super easy. Link to Fire and Blood is there if you want to pre-order that as well, because, you know, George deserves some gold dragons here and there too. But we will be back next week with another discussion about the religions of ice and fire. Until then, I'm Aaron,
and I'm Anthony.
See ya.